I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Hello and welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. We are finally here to talk about Picard Season 3 that we, at least my Star Trek regulars in the round table, have been very excited to talk about. It's been 10 weeks of me like waiting for Issa to catch up because he refuses to watch it week to week. I insisted on watching it week to week, and I cannot believe he waited. Did you manage to stay unspoiled, Issa?
I did. I got no spoilers whatsoever the whole time.
Holy
and
shit.
I finished the finale this morning. So perfect.
Okay. But we have a special guest Trekker here today. John Ortiver is a professional Trekker. But before we get to him, twice. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a second. But I do have to shamelessly plug my novel that comes out this summer, The Last Night to Kill Nazis, which you can pre-order now from Clash Books. It's World War II with a Jewish commando.
With Nazis.
And a vampire who kills Nazis. So you got to love that, right? And you know, if you're a regular, this is our seventh Star Trek breakdown, guys. Seventh time we've broke down a season of Star Trek together. So my regular bridge crew, Issa Diao, tell the folks who you are and a brief Star Trek history for you, because most people will already know it.
Yeah, I don't want to bore people's pants off, but Star Trek, I grew up on the original series, and then I really, you know, the Next Generation was sort of my favorite time of Star Trek. That was I was in high school, and it was, you know, all my friends would get together and we'd watch it, and that was, you know, I absolutely loved that show. And then I've been on and off with Star Trek ever since. I haven't seen all of Deep Space Nine. I've seen some of Voyager. I watched most of Enterprise, you know, and I've caught back up as the new ones have come out recently. But I was a musician for many years, and so I'd be traveling, and it was hard to keep up with all the TV shows. So
though on tour is how you and I met. So
that's true.
That's right.
Deep
Space Nine hat, you talked to me about Star Trek.
Yeah. By the average person standards, I'm a huge Star Trek nerd. In this group, I'm like an occasional watcher, you know, who dabbles. you know, I've read a few books, but I haven't read all of them, that sort of thing. So
right.
That's my
Sarah Lynn Mishner is a active and vocal Star Trek fan who you can find lurking on Star Trek shit posting and all over the internet talking about Star Trek, and who I just kept seeing her on different discussion panels. And I heard her on Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, thought she was great, recruited her for my show. Now she's a regular. She'll forever be in my Star Trek circle. Sarah, tell the folks who you are.
I started watching as soon as the TNG pilot came out. I remember being 8 years old and watching it on the floor on a beanbag chair and being like, you know, love at first sight experience. Like I was just like absolutely in heaven, and I've been a big fan ever since. And I had sort of like a upbringing similar to Annika Hansen. I was raised by crazy evangelicals. So Star Trek was just like my real parent. And I clung to it and I suckled it. I like got all of the nutrients I could from it because it was like everything that I was being denied. And actually somebody asked recently, they didn't understand why Seven prefers to go by Seven instead of Annika. And I was like, hello. Annika reminds her of being a powerless child and being put in this position and being, you know, having horrible things done to her. But Seven is something that she has reclaimed, that is her, that is, you know, her life and what she remembers, and she has you know, made the best of the situation and everything. Anyway, so yeah, I have been following pretty much, I've seen almost all of Star Trek. I didn't watch the animated series much because there are very few episodes of that that are suitable for adults, very unlike Prodigy. I feel like it's just kind of, I feel like they tried to really make a kids show for the most part, but.
Well, the animated series was excellent back in the day when there was literally nothing else on TV for kids. Like Saturday morning, have like an hour of cartoons. And that was all you got. So that was exciting. Since David's gone, John, why don't you tell us about yourself a little bit and your work with Star Trek?
Well, I found Star Trek at an age when other people find religion. I grew up watching TOS reruns. See, you guys really don't know what it was like when that's all we had.
I just turned 51, so I remember life.
I just turned 61.
Okay, you got you.
By
got
the time
me.
You whippersnapper came along, there was TAS already.
Well, I don't.
TAS was a godsend.
Well, and I should introduce the fine looking man in the robe there. John Ordover is one of my, like, his era of Star Trek that he oversaw is very important to me because I'm a big Star Trek reader. And John's professional history with Star Trek involves being the editor of the Star Trek books during the 90s. And
1992 to 2003.
Yes, and including the Star Trek New Frontier series, which you co-created with Peter David, who wrote the books, and has one Admiral Elizabeth Shelby, who I believe you gave her her first name, right?
Yes, we realized when we were going into this, we wanted to use the character and that she should probably have a first name, despite the long Star Trek tradition of people who only have one name, like, you know, Spock, Data, Cher, like that. right. And we just went with the actress's name.
Right. And you also wrote co-wrote two episodes of Deep Space Nine, including Starship Down, which is one of my favorite episodes.
Interesting. Most people pick It's Only a Paper Moon.
Right. Well, which, you know, is an important episode. But for me, Starship Down has Balance of Terror feel to it, which is one of my, is my favorite
episode.
A little bit. But John, tell the folks a little bit about your history with Star Trek.
Well, I grew up watching and loving it. At some point in my life, after college type stuff, I'm talking to your empty room.
It's for the people at home. They're the masses of people at home watching.
And I moved back to New York to
dog management.
To get into publishing. And I worked at Tor Books for a while. And while I was doing that, earlier before I got into that, I had been reading this incoming Slush manuscripts for the Star Trek novel series, because once you start freelancing, you start networking. And I called Kevin Ryan, who was the editor at the time. And he said, I don't have a budget for a freelance reader right now. Call me every 3 months. So I called every 3 months and he eventually said, I do have a budget now. Let's talk a little bit. Why do you want to read Slush for Star Trek novels? And I said, because I want to turn the fact that I know Spock's blood type into cold hard cash. And that apparently was the right reason. So I read hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of submissions.
Right. And you had a really unique position because as editor of that line during the Berman golden age, right? You had to interface with the studio and with product management and, like, you know, you were overseeing things like, you know, Captain Janeway's backstory. And by the way, this episode is going to start with a video introduction of me visiting the Janeway statue in my hometown that we share.
Okay.
Before our stuff starts. And but so you had to work with Jerry Taylor, for example, on Mosaic, the novel.
Well, it's you make it sound like some kind of burden.
Well, I don't mean that, but it was she amazing, I'm sure.
She and I had been chatting mostly overseeing Star Trek stuff was handled by licensing. And my major interface there was Paula Block, who was a joy to work with. I mean, we had our differences of opinion at times, but we worked them out. She never killed anything without coming up with a way for us to do it or having us talk it out.
Mm-hmm.
And was very, very helpful in a lot of things, like getting New Frontier started would not have happened if she hadn't been able to convince the powers that be that it was an acceptable thing to do.
Right. To start your own Star Trek series. Yeah.
But in any case, as part of interfacing with Jerry Taylor, I said, hey, Jerry, you want to write a novel for us?
Right.
And she said, well, I have no, I don't know what I'd want to write about. And I said, how about Janeway's backstory? You're the only one who can do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
You're the only one who can write the backstory of the character because everyone else, you know, we'd be stopped left and right, but nobody can tell you it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Or you, and she said, okay. I mean, I didn't have an abrasive interaction with the staff. I had a very pleasant reaction. Every once in a while, I'd come up with an idea. Like when we did the Eugenics Wars novels.
With Greg Cox.
By Greg Cox.
With Greg Cox, friend of the podcast, been on before.
Yes. Friend of mine. but enough sucking up to Greg Cox. and considering your opening discussion, yeah, enough sucking cocks. In any case.
Okay.
John, I don't know what kind of podcast you think this is, but this is a family podcast.
That's worse. In any case, I knew I wanted to do the Eugenics Wars because time was, we'd already passed when it was supposed to be set. And it was one of those things where if we don't do it now, we never will.
Right.
And the big discussion, the big question was, do we have an actual all-out war?
Or a
which
Cold
would
War.
Set up Star Trek as a completely different timeline? Or do we stick with the general sense that Star Trek is our possible future? And we knew no matter what we picked, some fans would hate it. So I dropped a line Ron Moore. And said, hey, Ron, I'm having trouble making this decision. I don't want to firmly say that Star Trek is not the future, but we'd have to, otherwise we'd have to do it as, you know, sort of behind the scenes. And he said, and we had a nice discussion about whether Star Trek should be maintained as a possible future. We decided to go with that. So the Eugenics Wars happened. And you didn't see it.
It was a Cold War and very X-Files-y and very good. I love those novels. So, so John, you're going to be here specifically as part of this panel to comment on Star Trek Picard episode or season 3, but we will get a little bit of your opinions of the first two seasons. Listeners of the show can find our opinions. We were, I'm generally a defender of season 1. Sarah is as well. I'm not as big of a fan of season 2. And Sarah tried very hard to convince Issa and I that it was better than we thought.
Let me jump in with a limitation that I guess we should have discussed before I came on the show.
Right. So what
I used to be the guy from my upbringing, mm-hmm. from my schooling from first grade to 12th grade, with the most Star Trek cred.
Right.
Unfortunately, Akiva Goldsman was 2 years ahead of me.
Oh, at the same school?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
And Michelle Hurd.
Yeah, exactly.
Was 4 years behind me with her sister in my class.
That's interesting. So you have a lot of Star Trek Picard connections here.
Yes. It's sort of like I will comment to the extent that I can, but not perhaps with any level of viciousness.
Okay. I can't imagine this crowd being vicious about anything.
Okay, good. Because I was going to say, basically, Star Trek Picard was done. This would be a way to look at it. Was done by the guys from my old garage band.
Right.
That's right. So cool.
Oh, that is awesome. And look, here's the thing. The way I feel about, and I think this is important to this discussion, because we are talking about Picard season 3, is that my personal feeling on, like, I know a lot of people have recently bashed the idea that Patrick Stewart said, no uniforms, no starships. I actually love that there was finally a Star Trek show that wasn't so Starfleet centric. Like, I loved having something in that universe, something you guys kind of played with the engineering novels, like that had, you know, and you guys did that. You had a couple novels that were outside of the Starfleet, like directly the Starfleet purview and stuff. So I've always wanted to see that Star Trek universe expand. And I personally like Star Trek, or I like Picard season 1 for what it is. My problem with the season 2 is that it got too far away from it and spent too much time in our modern world. And I just don't like season 2. And also, Q's never been one of my favorite adversaries. So, what? Yes, it's just, I'm not anti-Q. I like some Q stories. I'm just saying he's not my favorite. So I got that going on. But
he just appeared right behind you. No, sorry.
Yeah. But the whole thing about Patrick Stewart's guidelines that he didn't want it to be like just another Star Trek show, I actually thought was a positive. And it's clear that when Terry Metalis went to him and said, yeah, that's great, but this is going to be a TNG season 8, basically. Season 3.
Right.
And I think, you know, at that point, like, I think it was hard for Patrick Stewart to say, you know, he'd done 2 seasons the other way, so it was a little bit easier to say, like, okay, now we're going to put on uniforms and we're going to be on a starship. And I think that one of the reasons why the fans are so high on this season is because of, you know, it's, you know, Ira Stephen Bear had the attitude that I don't care what the fans want, I'm going to give them what they need, right? And whereas it seems like Terry Metalis was definitely saying, I'm going to give the fans what they want. I'm going to give them a lot of what they want. And for that reason, I think season 1 is like a healthy smoothie and season 3 is like a cake, and it's delicious, but it's very sweet. Right. That's my analogy. But anyways, let's now get into, if you don't want to go deep on seasons 1 and 2, I get that, John. But season 3, we're here to talk about, so we're going to have to get into it. And one thing that I definitely want to say also is there's some mirroring going on with Terry Metalis and Dave Filoni from the Star Wars world, because once the Star Wars prequels became a disaster and Dave Filoni became this like savior to the fans, there's a degree that they're trying to set this up for. A lot of fans are doing this with Terry Metalis, that give Terry Metalis the keys to Star Trek and that he's the savior of Star Trek, as if Alex Kurtzman had nothing to do with producing this season of Star Trek. And I just want to say, if you think that, you're nuts. Alex Kurtzman is the executive producer of all things Star Trek. He oversaw this entire season, and that talk's got to stop. Because, in my opinion, like, Alex Kurtzman's involved with all of it, and that's just the way it is. So, does anyone else want to talk about...
Let me give a quick opening speech for this.
Sure.
It'll only be a couple hours, don't worry.
I'm listening, but I'm going to go do dog stuff while you're talking.
Okay.
David,
stay in your chair. I know it's Star Trek, but don't keep falling out of your chair. In any case, when it comes to this sort of creative collaboration, and every episode of television you've ever seen is a creative collaboration, it is very, very difficult to pick apart who came up with what, who's responsible for what direction someone went, suggested that they decide to go with. It's almost impossible. It's sort of like saying, well, which guy on the football team won the game? Well, if you actually look at it very closely, it could be one unnamed defensive back who tackled the other quarterback at exactly the right moment. I mean, it doesn't possible. And like Peter David and I came up with New Frontier together, but neither of us really remembers 100% who came up with what.
Right.
And if we don't, I mean, I like to say, I just came up with a general concept, and after that, it's a blur.
Right.
And so picking out any one person and blaming them for it or applauding them for it, I mean, even original Star Trek, a lot of the credit given to Roddenberry really belongs to Gene L. Coon.
And Dorothy Fontana.
Dorothy Fontana. I mean, you have to mix it all. It's been put through a blender. You can't sort it out. Right. Also, frankly, the last good, from my point of view as an old crank, the last good Star Wars movie was released in 1977.
It has not been a good Star Wars movie. It's a whole different podcast now.
Well,
yeah, okay, go on.
To confirm what you're saying, like one of the things that I learned when I did that Dorothy Fontana article and I started reading all like the memos and behind the scene things, for example, like the Federation was completely a creation of Dorothy Fontana for Journey to Babel, right? For that episode, like there was no Federation before that. And in the notes for the treatment, she's basically creating the Federation, and everything that like we still think of now as the Federation was just in this random episode where all she really wanted to do was have Spock interact with his parents, right? In the beginning.
Right.
And came up with this whole framework. So yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I just, on the idea that Terry Metalis, and I have a lot of respect for Terry Metalis, the showrunner of this season. We have mutual friends who speak very highly of him, spoke very highly of him right when he got the job, like long before. And I don't know how he stays on Twitter and interacts with every nitpick that people make of this series, and he responds to them. And for the most part, I really enjoy his commentary, except for when he said that number one, John Luke's dog was a changeling. That's not funny. I don't like that. But besides that,
that is fucked up. I didn't know that.
Yeah, every time people ask him what happened to number one, he says he was a changeling. That's his response. And I'm like, that's not funny. I don't find that funny at all.
Especially since it's a pity. That's fucked up.
Hey, look, I'm still stuck that I'm now talking to someone who thinks A New Hope is better than Empire Strikes Back.
You are. I'll go on a different show. I'll go into details why.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone say that before. That's fantastic. So we'll some other time, another place.
I know one other person that feels that way, but Well, and I do think that there's something to being in the theater the first time.
And let me yes, in the theater the first time, in 1979, watching Empire Strikes Back, you have to remember, guys, someone my age, it didn't end. Right. And we didn't know how many years it would be until there was another one.
Fair, back fair to enough. It isn't a complete movie. I will give you that. It's a middle movie, for sure.
Okay.
So back to the other franchise.
So, Issa, well, let's go. Sarah, I'm sure you have an opinion on the Terry Metalis being anointed savior. I think he would find that annoying, you know, but what do you feel about that?
I've been so annoyed because the last 3 days, I basically just decided I need to stay off the groups for the next 2 weeks until the white men get it out of their systems, because they are just fanboying over him so hard. And it's like, you know, and it's so irritating, because not only are multiple people, you know, responsible for all of these things, but they are saying things like, you know, well, they have a petition to bring Shaw back from the dead, which is fine. They did the same fucking thing with Pike. When Discovery season 2 came out, they fell in love with Pike, even though Burnham was an incredible character. They needed that white male charismatic captain, no matter what. They desperately needed that. And they did not know how to function and did not know how to empathize with other characters without that. So they lose their fucking minds every time that happens.
They started Burnham by having her mutiny and pull a phaser on her own captain.
Which
was
great.
That's not exactly the most...
Which was great, because it usurped the expectations of what you would want from Star Trek.
Captain would not be a mutineer.
I think she would. That's a discussion for another day. But, so, these guys are saying things like, you know, kick Seven out of the captain's chair so that Shaw can take it back. I won't watch Star Trek Legacy unless, you know, that happens. I didn't even
know people are saying that. That's ridiculous.
Oh yeah, it's fucked up. People are saying that they won't watch the Section 31 movie unless Terry Metalis is involved. And it's like, come on, guys. All he did, he had the easiest job of any of the showrunners that we've had for Star Trek Picard. He didn't have to deal with
the
pandemic.
For any of the modern Star Trek, he had the easiest.
Yeah. Yeah, like he pretty much just had to let the nostalgia do its thing. And there are just as many plot holes and things in season 3 as there were in season 1 and 2. And so every criticism that they took so seriously, you know, like the idea that, for instance, oh, we're just going to plug this iPod into a toaster and make a phaser. They do that all the time in Star Trek. They did it in season 1 and season 2 of Picard, and these guys were absolutely up in arms about it. They did it in season 3, like 3 or 4 times. And they were like, yes, this is good writing. So the double standards drive me up the wall.
Well, and I don't think Terry Metalis would actually have that. I think he'd probably think it's a lot of this is ridiculous and silly too. And the thing, it should be reminded that Terry Metalis started as a production assistant on Voyager. And Jeri Ryan has even said that her earliest memories of Terry Metalis was him knocking on her trailer door and delivering a script, right? You know, and he came up from nothing in Star Trek, and we should appreciate the fact that they took the piss out of him to name the most awful planet on Enterprise, Metalis Prime. Everyone thinks he did this as, you know, himself on the show, but it was actually done on Enterprise as a joke to make fun of him. And so I have a certain amount of sympathy for Terry, that he did not mean to get turned into the patron saint of white boy Star Trek fans.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, you know, and I give him credit for like being on Twitter and fighting, arguing with everybody. But at the same time, like, I do wish that the one thing I wish he would do would be to give the rest of the creatives, Kurtzman and all that, to a little bit more shout out, saying like, hey, we're all, he does it with his team that he worked on the season with, but he hasn't done it with the upper management quite as much, in my opinion. But at the same time, I have great respect for, also his 12 Monkeys show is greatly underrated. It was way better than I ever expected. And so I respect him as a creator. And I didn't know until last night when I was watching an interview with him that he oversaw a season of MacGyver. And now I want to watch the season of MacGyver just because that's weird and funny. But that being said, Issa, do you have any comments? Have you, you don't follow any?
I don't follow any of this. I don't know who these people are. I hear names. They, you know, I'm like, was this a character? No, then I don't know. You know, I don't follow the behind the scenes, but it's always interesting to hear about it from you guys.
The bottom line is you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. You don't know who does what. You don't know what pressure things were under. You don't know what screwed up at the last minute and the janitor tossed out the idea that saved the episode. You just don't know. And it's never only one person.
Right.
Never.
Right.
Except if it's me. Then it's one person. No.
It's- if it's you and it's good. If you liked it and I did it, then that was me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to go too far on that, but I do, you know, the same thing happened in Star Wars with Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau. As soon as The Mandalorian came out, they were going to save Star Wars. And everybody wanted them to do everything Star Wars. And then they put Lizzo and Jack Black in an episode of The Mandalorian. And all of a sudden, people were like, maybe they're not perfect, you know? But
so gross. Yeah. Always the usual suspects, too. Always the same guys.
Yeah.
Well, ruining every fandom.
Right, exactly. And so Star Trek has their own and, you know, Star Wars has their own. And so the funny thing is that, you know, like I said, I have mutual, I have one friend who used to work in the office right next to the Paramount lot. And he used to accidentally run into Terry Metalis during like his lunch break. And they became friends because they were talking about each other's t-shirts. Like, that's how the level of, like, one of these friends. Another one's a professional who worked with him. But this guy used to, like, he said Terry would sit down and have lunch with them, and then they'd start talking about anime for, like, hours. And so, like, I get it. He's a genuine guy. And you can tell that the cast and crew all love working for him. That being said, the fan anointment is a little bit annoying. Now, but I want to be as done with that as I can be and just talk about the merits of the show at this point. So, starting with Issa, your overall thoughts, knowing that we're going to break it down more later.
My overall thoughts, I have to explain how I am
your opening salvo.
Yeah. So I'm of two minds, right? I watched the whole thing, almost the whole thing, with a giant stupid smile on my face, having a great time, enjoying the hell out of watching it, right? Because that was like, you know, in my childhood, it was like, I love these characters. But if I'm at all objective about it, most of it I thought was pretty terrible. And so you have to hold those two things together, because obviously I don't think it was terrible. But if it had been like some new thing that wasn't Star Trek and they had done the things that they did, which we'll get into, I would have been like, you've got to be kidding me, right? But since it was like, I love these characters, I know these characters, I just want to see them do their thing and I don't care what they do, I loved it. And I sort of said that about the first two seasons, but this one was a little more, this one was more. It was like I'm just going to give a really quick example. And again, I loved the show. It was a fantastic season, right? But so we have Rafi, and we find out her handler is Worf. And then we find out that Worf's handler is Ro. And it was just like an extra layer of, they just vamped Rafi and Worf.
Oh, come on, there's only like eight people in Starfleet. You know that.
Totally. But it was like they could have that whole part was just so extra useless and painful that I love Worf was so good in this, but it was like the whole Rafi's whole arc, not arc, but her story for the first half of the season just added nothing. It was just like, why is this happening? Like, they could have.
Oh, I disagree. But
they could have just had Worf doing it, and then Worf could have been reporting to Ro, and you'd have the exact same thing. That one example, right? I mean, there's there's more, but just like, but I still loved it. I had a great time. I really, I also noticed that I felt very different about the characters that I know less. Like, so the Next Generation characters, I, every second on the screen, I had that smile on my face. I was loving it. You know, I feel good about 7 or 9. Rafi, I feel, I didn't really love her stuff. Like, I felt like she could have easily not been in this and it would have been fine. I mean, her acting's great. There's nothing against the character. She was good in the other seasons. I just didn't think she, there was one part where they were clearly, you know, obviously they're getting the old crew together and that's the whole point. But it was like Rafi and Seven stayed behind so that the old crew could be together. And it was just so forced. It was kind of hilarious. But,
right, but that wasn't her fault.
No, of course. But I'm just saying, like, just some part of my mind while I'm watching this is like, this is very contrived. But at the same time, I loved it, right? I was like,
I'm sure that when they said we're sitting around the table again, I really thought, oh, I wonder, and Picard, of course, will get to carve the turkey. I mean, it felt like Thanksgiving.
Right. Totally. Well, and I will say the thing with Rafi, the only thing that annoyed, I like Rafi as a character, but it was weird to me that Picard didn't like, that he was like, oh, I'm with my old buddies, so I don't care about you anymore. They developed their friendship so well in the first two seasons. The fact that he barely acknowledged her seemed weird to me.
But if you say the plot out loud, like what, like quickly describe what happened on the show, you're like, well, this happened and this happened and this happened. There is so much stuff that happened. They should have cut out about half of it and it would have been a million times better. But, you know, again, I smile on my face. So,
right. Well, see, I have a very nostalgic reaction to Picard 3 as well.
Yeah.
But it's more like, wow. For the first half of it, at least, what part of Wrath of Khan are they going to put in this time? Picard already has a long lost son. Then they get stuck in a net. Then they hide in a nebula. Hey, that's just the top of it. I mean, just...
And so, John, you might not have made it all the way to the third movie here, so you might not know what I'm talking about. But the end of the season was pretty much a remake of Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yes. Anything in which the finale is to blow up the thing we already blowed up a couple of times before.
Right. And fly out of the explosion.
It's going to be Return of the Jedi.
Fly out of the explosion, the father son thing in the middle of it, the three different battles. It was Return of the Jedi.
It was Return of the Jedi. Yeah.
Yeah. Sarah, what were your overall opening salvo thoughts on the season?
I mean, I loved it. I loved the nostalgia, but I definitely saw a ton of flaws, and a lot of them having to do with plot contrivances and things like that, that I can get into later. But you know, like overall, I don't think people will really appreciate seasons 1 and 2 of Picard until Patrick Stewart has died. Hopefully he will die when he's 137 years old. He's, you know, in great shape. So that's going to happen. I'm hoping.
Well, he's in an android body now.
Right.
That should help.
I mean, Patrick Stewart himself. That's what I think that as soon as... Because I think that... And it's sad to me because I feel like there's the same homogenization that's happening at Netflix where something has to do so well in order to get remade, in order to get a second season, means that these very arty, very thoughtful series are not being given second or third seasons, right? We saw that happen with the OA. And because of the structure of the way that Netflix works, and what happens is this homogenization is happening where everything feels a little bit the same because it has to be broad reaching enough that it creates a huge audience. It has to have a huge audience or else. And that I feel, I'm a little worried that is kind of happening with Star Trek.
Yeah, that's called,
because I don't,
that's called television.
Yeah.
Well, I know, but the beauty of the streaming era is that for a brief moment in time, we had the space for some very unique programs that didn't have to have a huge following. But I think because the economics have grown with it and because of the way that capitalism comes in, it ruins everything. You know, here we are. So the thing is, you know, when Patrick Stewart announced that he was doing this show, and he said that he was only interested in doing it if it wasn't TNG, and he said that, you know, he wanted it to be this this much more intimate thing that took advantage of, you know, the format, I think, of the new golden age of television and all that stuff. I expected a couple of thoughtful seasons of character study. And for the first two seasons, I got what I wanted. I wanted this deep dive into why Picard is the way that he is, you know, that fills out the character so that when
why Guinan is so much younger than she was in the episode set in the Gold Rush.
Visual stuff doesn't matter. Like, visual stuff really doesn't matter. You have to just accept the fact that, you know, in that case, for instance, it's more important to get a really good actress. So I expected that
a really good actress of the appropriate age.
I wanted a show that didn't treat Starfleet like Hogwarts, you know, that it didn't treat it like wish fulfillment, but dealt with how Starfleet would actually function as a bureaucracy that has to confront its tendency toward colonialist thinking that it did throughout TNG over and over and over again. It always worked out well for them because they were heroes. And I think that Picard, you know, or Patrick Stewart was sort of very much wanting to push back against some of those narratives. And I got what I wanted. I wanted a show that fixed problems created by the Berman era that were most keenly felt by the minorities it excluded or abused, despite Trek's long history of doing better in that department than so many other franchises. You know, Seven of Nine didn't have to wear an oxygen tank in order to deal with her costume. That's great. That's such progress, you know? And I got what I wanted. I wanted an intimate character study of who this character was. And that is what I got in seasons one and two. Season three was a nice wrap up to all of TNG. And I loved it. It was great. But I do have some criticisms of it. And I do have some things that, and it's so funny because so many of the things that people complained about with seasons one and two were also true about season three. Plot holes, like convoluted stories, bringing up too many things, not resolving threads that they started, you know? And so it's just hilarious to me that if you give Trekkies some nostalgia, anything is forgivable, anything is permissible.
Well, there's an inherent nostalgia to just doing more TNG instead of more, even with just Star Trek Picard, to doing more TNG related material rather than something completely new.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing. One of the things I loved about season one is that they allowed Jean-Luc to be old and to be flawed and to be an old man. And I loved that. And I think in the way, and I said this at the time, that I thought that season one of Picard was learning all the right lessons from The Last Jedi, from Star Wars, like the breaking the mold of the franchise, like letting the characters be old and flawed. And so what, I don't think season three of Picard is as bad as Rise of Skywalker was.
Oh, come on. How can you even say those in the same sentence?
They're not, because Picard season three was fun and it had really good moments. And Rise of Skywalker was just a train wreck. But
here's where I think you're completely wrong, which, you know, means you are wrong because yes. I said it.
I kind of went too far
the
there.
The problem I admit that. with the next Star Trek, the Star Wars trilogy, was you had under contract Carrie Fisher, Harrison Ford, and you told a story about other people.
Right.
I mean, sort of something like, what we had wanted, what the Star Wars fans had wanted all these years was to get the gang back together.
Right.
And they sort of like Wrath of Khan. You got the gang back together and you started sliding in supporting characters.
Right.
In Star Wars, they flipped it for reasons that are inescapable to me. I mean, if you just made a movie with Han, Luke, Leia, Chewie, R2, C-3PO, C-3PO wasn't really in the first movie.
No, I have to disagree because of the Force Awakens actually set everything up really well. It introduced some new characters. It had the mystery of Luke and we had Han show up and we had Leia. And if Carrie Fisher hadn't passed away, unfortunately, then we
probably the third movie was supposed to be her movie.
So I think I'm still mad about that.
They did
set up the old and the new very well. If you're a kid, my kids were just old enough to see Force Awakens in the theater, or my older kid was. She loved it, you know, like it worked. And so I give them a pass for not just doing a older Star Wars characters, you know, reunion show or whatever.
It doesn't have to just be that, but it has to be primarily that. Again, Wrath of Khan. What happens there? Well, it didn't wind up going that way into the future, but the idea was we lose Spock and gain Sobek.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, well, the next movie, we lose McCoy and gain Joanna. In the next movie, we lose Kirk and we get... In other words...
But they didn't go that way.
Sort it.
We lost the Enterprise in Search for Spock.
Yeah,
that's what we lost. But
yes, but we lost a character you could build another one of.
Yeah.
But never mind. Back to...
Okay, I think I've got where we're all generally feeling. We all think it's... Well, no, John, I didn't get your overall thoughts. What are your...
My overall thought about Picard was that there were occasionally some things... It was wonderful. But... And I'll tell you why. TNG, and you know, you whippersnappers may feel differently about this. The problem with TNG is they had this bar on emotions. Emotions couldn't go up higher than this, and they couldn't go down lower than this. I mean, they had a whole episode in which Beverly was saved from a life of orgasms. Because... You just couldn't take the emotions up past a certain point. And the result was these excellent actors were to some extent hobbled. Then you come along and there's Star Trek Picard, and suddenly all the restraints are off. The writing is really good. The actors are allowed to act to the maximum of their ability. And that, to me, that's what drove Star Trek Picard. Oh my gosh, they're doing TNG, but with the blinders off.
HR department in space. I always thought that TNG was HR department in space, as much as I loved it. And I feel like that's Roddenberry's influence because he wanted this utopia. And so nobody got to have feelings because we've solved feelings by the 24th century. And it's like, come on.
So that was my huge positive for Picard. I think there were some budget restrictions that you can see. I think sometimes they did two episodes that should have been one episode.
Definitely.
I mean, you can
get the same cliffhanger twice.
They fought the strike far too long. I'm sitting here thinking, wait a minute, you're doing Wrath of Khan. So what you do, and the Shrike is loaded with weapons. Well, you use your computers to override their weapons and blow them up on their own ship. I mean, Kirk would have had this down in 5 minutes.
I think the main concern, and this is my nitpick hat, but it was really the main problem with it, I thought, watching it all at once, you know, binging it, was that the first half, the only thing that mattered in the entire first half was the relationship between Picard and Beverly and Jack, or Picard and Jack specifically. And everything else that happened sort of didn't matter. And it was just like you could.
I think if they'd blown up the ship with all the characters on it, you might have felt differently.
No.
But okay.
What I mean is I apologize for not knowing the episode number, but I'm pretty sure you could tell someone, hey, Picard has a son with Dr. Crusher, and here's a quick 30-second explanation. Start the season on episode 5 and end up just as happy with that.
Don't they have birth control in their era?
Well, I thought it was implied that she got pregnant on purpose, but I didn't know if they didn't really dive into that. You know,
I don't think so.
And a lot of the explanations did not land. It's not believable that Beverly wouldn't have told Picard.
Right.
I thought they handled that pretty well. Like, at no point was I like, this is ridiculous.
The idea is that she didn't want his life to be in danger because he would be known as Picard's son. And what did we find them doing? Hopping around the galaxy, getting shot at. And he's like, no, I didn't want
to. That sort of proves her point, though, right? I mean, like as she kept him away from Picard, he wasn't in danger, right? Or at least she didn't know. Like,
well, they got into their own form of danger, but yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and that was, you know, obviously they were repeating the Wrath of Khan thing. I did see an interview with Terry Metalis where he was saying that he was afraid to suggest the idea that the son be Beverly's in the and that he suggested the son storyline, and he said Patrick Stewart was like, it should be Beverly's. And then he was like, yes, great idea. Great idea, because he was afraid to suggest it.
That's awesome.
To Patrick Stewart. And so it's funny because how that kind of came about. But I don't know. I didn't mind that. I found it. What I found unbelievable is that, and look, we'll get into the Justice for Laris thing eventually, but the lady who hid your child from you for 20 years, or the one who's running your chateau, you know, first of all, I did not understand season one, why you don't take the ex-Tal Shiar agent with you on your mission in that one. And I certainly don't see why you don't say, hey, sweetie, I got this issue. You are a master spy. Come help us. And I know some people were like, well, that wouldn't have worked with Beverly. Come on. That's good tension. That's good drama. So Laris should have been there, and you will never find, first of all.
Well, at the very least, Laris was a trustworthy person back on Earth who could have worked from the other end.
At the very
least. I agree.
Yeah. And number one's not a changeling. No.
She even said no Starfleet, and Laris is not Starfleet. So it was perfect. And I saw one of the fandom magazines like call her his housekeeper, and this was maybe 2-3 months ago, and I was like, what? Housekeeper? What?
No. She's
a badass.
She showed how capable she was in season one, like in the very, like at the beginning. And so as a character, she should have been there. And you know, that was a major thing for me on that, but you know, I'll live with that. The one thing that I thought was the worst writing is that the two episodes in a row that had the same cliffhanger. Like, if I think one thing that would have fixed this whole season is if you take out the second episode in a row where a cliffhanger is what is Jack, right?
Yes.
And then you get rid of that and you introduce the whole Borg storyline one episode earlier and take your time solving the Borg thing, it would have been more interesting. I groaned a lot at the beginning of when they revealed that it was the Borg, but I understand that it makes sense that the worst thing that ever happened to John Luke was the best of both worlds.
The problem is, when you think about it, the plot is too convoluted. The Borg, who are starving themselves and about to die, and I don't know why. I don't know.
Janeway poisoned them all at the end of Voyager.
Okay. So
the Borg being a boss.
Okay. So the Borg are not doing well. So they come up with a plan to work with the changelings, who they have a common enemy with, to infiltrate all of Starfleet, to do this transporter thing, to then be able to have their, you know, Jack, who's now become this transmitter. And it was just like, are you kidding? Like, they
would. Well, two things to that. One, I loved that McCoy was right
about the transporters.
After all these years, it's a damn stupid way to travel, scattering a man's molecules all over the universe. Oh. It is. Okay. That's one. this way. I loved that. Two, with Jack, if you're going to do something where someone's eyes change, you're calling back to where no man has, and give them superpowers.
Yep.
You're calling back to where no man has gone before. You're calling strongly back to Gary Mitchell. And you at least have to recognize that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was
and
my
then having thought. It turn out to only be the Borg.
Yeah.
What I found was a little less than it could have been.
Yeah. Well, I just think the changeling served almost no purpose in the show. And the villain Vadic, the Shrike, that was completely useless. If that was edited completely out of the show, I would have enjoyed it a lot more. Like, well, she was so over the top, like Shakespearean and crazy, and just that did not work for me at all.
I mean, okay, here's the thing.
You throw in something that hasn't worked for me in any of the newer shows.
Okay.
And this one too, for the most part, until toward the end of this one.
So
it seems they've forgotten phasers have stun settings.
Right. Well, that too, sure.
They really have. I mean, it's like there was this whole thing of
now they have transporters.
Where, oh, you have no choice but to kill me before I'm taken over by, like, what do you mean? She just set your phaser on stun.
Right.
And there seemed to be like so many options where that was the solution, and they just had to disintegrate someone instead.
Also, you liked the Shakespearean crazy villain?
Oh, you're talking about me?
I think it went on a bit too long.
Oh, yeah. Sarah, you had something you looked like you were about to say about that, though.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, so but we're old thing. White men. We get to talk.
Go, Sarah.
Here's the thing. The biggest problem that I had with Picard season 3 was that, you know, there were 3 interconnected things that they got wrong that they could have fixed by putting them all together, okay? One, I hate the way that they just sort of told us through exposition that Borg and changelings were working together. They didn't show it at all. They didn't connect those dots at all. They just told us, and we were supposed to buy it. Okay, fine. I hated the way that Jack found out he had Borg bits, okay? I hated the way that Vadic went out. And here's the thing. There was absolutely no reason for Deanna and Picard to be the ones who are like, sorry, Jack, we don't trust you now. All of a sudden, they would have known how he would react. They made that happen. They made him go off and basically commit mass murder because he goes off to the Borg cube, which is obviously what he would have done. Deanna is a fucking empath. She knows better. She knows. She just sat there
and
telling
if she
him,
had a phaser
you can trust
on
us.
Sun.
You can trust us. We won't hurt you. You can. And then she immediately is like, oh, there's protocol. They don't give a fuck about protocol. That was so stupid. And he didn't. The only way that would have worked is if he had shown any aggression at all toward the good people. Like, he only used his Borg parts for the changelings. You know, he never showed any kind of aggression towards the good people. And so that whole thing didn't work. And so all they had to do was have Vadic be the one to tell him that he was Borg. And then she could have delivered him to the Borg.
Absolutely.
She serves her purpose. You know, and the thing is, she had a point. Like, I loved her speech. I loved the performance. And I think the reason that they gave her that many episodes is because they recognized that she was Christopher Plummering the shit out of that shit. Okay? She did such a good job. They were like, let's give her more
airtime. Apple did not far fall from the tree.
Didn't ruin for me at all. Like, I was just like, what is going on? This is terrible. Who is this woman and why is she talking? Why is she
but
crazy?
Like, if she had been the one to deliver him. And like,
I agree with you on
speech,
that.
Yeah, no, Sarah, you're totally right. Your version is a million times better.
Picard, you know, and not knowing that Section 31 was doing these terrible things, I hate the fact that they never went back and addressed that. All I asked for was, if you're going to put that in there and you're going to make us root for her in this tiny way and be like, she's got a point, is at the end, have a conversation where Patrick Stewart is sitting down with an admiral, whatever, Patrick, you know, Jean-Luc Picard is sitting down with an admiral and saying, hey, if we're going to have a Section 31, they can't do war crimes. They can't, or else I'm out. I'm not going to save the galaxy anymore. Because y'all are creating these problems, and that never got addressed. You know, and it's like they made us sympathize with her for no reason, and then they gave her a shitty death.
Well, they could do that in Star Trek Legacy if, you know, hopefully. But
speaking of Star Trek Legacy.
Yeah, no, well, we'll get to Star Trek Legacy a little bit more later.
Okay.
But to follow, I agree with you, Sarah, that having Vadic deliver Jack would have solved a lot of problems. It would have solved a lot. And also, but I did like Amanda Plummer in this role. I did like her as a weirder villain and kind of having the con role. I will say one of the things I do want to say before we go too much further is that I think the best episode, much like Strange New Worlds, episode 4 was the banger. I think the best episode of this entire
season. Which one was episode 4? Refresh my memory there.
That's the one where they no-win scenario where they escape the nebula with the space babies and Crusher solving the issue with sciencing the shit out of it. And because that's the one that I felt the most like Star Trek. That, you know, when people say, one of the things that's annoyed me about Picard is I keep hearing over and over again from people, this is the best Star Trek's been in 30 years. Well, first of all, I disagree. And second of all, have these people not watched Strange New Worlds? That's my first thing. because I think Strange New Worlds is better, in my opinion, than this season. The first season of Strange New Worlds.
That one fairy tale episode, I completely.
Besides the one fairy tale episode, even though it made it, it had a Deep Space Nine Easter egg, and I appreciate that.
Throwback to the previous podcast discussion we had about that. So
yes. So the thing about Strange New Worlds and this season of Picard is the fourth episode is where for me it all came together. And this no-win scenario with the space babies and them solving it, and that was when it felt like Star Trek to me, more so than any other point in the season. And so at the end, you got all the nostalgia feelings. We got the Enterprise D. We got all that stuff, but it felt like a Star Trek movie to me, whereas the fourth episode felt like an episode of TNG.
But why did they have the portal weapon? Like, that was another thing that just completely was not necessary to the story.
Well, look, they're doing the changelings and all that, and Vadic, it's all red herrings, and I get that. And has anybody here seen the movie A Perfect Getaway? Okay, Perfect Getaway has a running joke in the movie where...
We only watch Star Trek. What? How do we make that clear?
So wait, there's Perfect Getaway is just such a generic name. I feel like I've seen it, but I don't know.
Perfect Getaway is a genius crime thriller movie. But there's a character who's supposed to be a screenwriter in it, and Timothy Oliphant's character keeps saying, "Oh, I could be a writer," and he keeps referring to the red snapper, and he's meaning to say the red herring. But the problem is now I constantly say red snapper when I'm meaning to say red herring, and very few people have seen that movie. So it just gets lost. And I just want to put that out there.
I have seen
it. Ever on this podcast ever say red snapper, that is what.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the Hawaii movie, right?
Yes.
I have seen that.
I think that's a great movie.
Let me jump in about the changelings.
Yes.
How is it that they no longer have the capacity to change into things that aren't human? Aren't humanoid?
They do.
I mean, like a desk.
Well, they do.
They go around scanning all these people. But in Deep Space Nine, when they had to scan for changelings, they had to scan the wall.
The whole room, yeah. Well, that's a good nitpick. I appreciate it.
I think it was from their genetic engineering in Section
3. Yeah, it must have been.
Yeah.
Well, and we do know that the changelings are, that these are rogue changelings and that they're not everybody. So who knows? I mean, I think that they can expand on that later. I think the thing that I did like about that, even though it was a red herring and it was like a misdirect, that the changelings, and I think it's good because to have an effect of the Dominion War is a good thing. It expands the universe and makes it feel more whole. I, in in the discussion in season one when they were talking about the aftermath of the Romulan explosion, and that they were, I always wanted them to say, and refugees from the Dominion War. I just wanted them to say it once or twice just to make it feel whole to me as a Deep Space Nine fan. That being said, I don't know. Anyways, did you guys have any moments, starting with Ethan? I'm going to go around. For me, it was episode 4 where I felt like this is a high point for the season. Before we get to the finale and the 1701D of it all, did you have any moments in the season that stood out for you as like a high point? Because for me, it was episode 4. Issa?
I don't know if I could point to a specific spot. There were definitely a few moments that I found very entertaining and literally like was laughing out loud while I watched it. One that stands out is when Beverly's at tactical at the end and she fires the phasers and photon torpedoes and hits everything and everyone just turns and looks at her. That was great. Worf had so many good parts that I've lost count.
I almost sent you the severed heads of my enemies, but I was told that would be passive aggressive.
Totally, that was great.
The headings are on Wednesdays. Yes, he had all the lines. Yeah.
Totally.
I don't remember that Riker Worf banter from the show.
No, that was
like a new right one. Here.
Yeah, that was good, right? Like, I will make it a threesome. You know, yeah. that was cute. I felt like they didn't quite get Geordi right. I was a little weirded out by the plot around, like, Geordi not being like, I'm going to help right away. You know, like, I, they were trying to give some tension or whatever, but it was like, you would have thought Geordi would have been more on board to help right away. And he was.
They just wanted to say that he had different priorities because of his daughters. Having children makes people incredibly selfish. That's why I do not plan on having children.
good move. But,
you're evenly split parents here.
And I think they set it up, but it was a budget issue more than anything else.
With the what?
I would have loved to, in the finale, to see all the ships cleared out of the museum.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, Worf on the Defiant.
Right.
Seven on the Voyager.
Oh, to have them all come to the, yeah, that they were all.
Had them all riding, you know, especially once Data said, apparently we are the cavalry. Well, yeah. Right. Once you say that, it would have been great if a cavalry had shown up.
Yeah, of all the old ships.
I mean, why not, right? You know, like, you're doing nostalgia so hard anyway. Why not bring on all the other old stuff, you know?
Right. It's a perfect example of Terry Metalis, like, using Twitter to set people straight. There were so many people when they first did the Starfleet Museum that said, oh, that was bullshit. They didn't show the Enterprise, you know, the original Enterprise. And then he was like, oh, no. And then like did screenshots that the NX-01 from Enterprise was there. It was just retrofitted the way they had planned to do it in season 5 and never got to, which was pretty darn deep nerdy. The fact that they stole the cloaking device from the Bird of Prey, from, you know, the fact I do like that they made the one with the whales canon in universe was great.
Right.
That was fantastic. I admit that the appearance of Voyager and the playing of the theme song actually made me teary eyed. And so that's where I have to admit that the appearance of a starship made me cry. That is a nerd admission. And the fact, I know it was partially Seven saying that's where I became, you know, that was my home and that's where I became a person. It all worked. The fan service there in the museum was great. I like the idea that Geordi is running the museum, that he would want to be fixing up old ships. But I do wish they had mentioned that he had been a captain on the Challenger. Like, and all good things, like, for a little while, because I in my head, the canon of Geordi being captain of the Challenger is important.
Not every career path in Starfleet leads to captain of a ship.
Sure.
Yeah. You have to have the right personality to be a captain. And I am sort of wary of this idea that they all have it, because they don't. They really don't. Like, Geordi wants to be tinkering. That makes more sense to me than him being a captain. I just don't see it.
They did that so well on TNG. There's that episode where Troy was doing like command training and then realizes she has to like send people off to their death. And she's like, nope,
that's not mine.
Yeah, don't want to do it. So that's a thing. But so let me think if there's anything in the first couple episodes that I know I want to talk about. What did you guys think of Jonathan Frakes this season? I thought he was amazing, and
he's the perfect example of what I mean by on the original TNG, the acting and emotions squished down.
Right.
And here they're not.
Yeah. So there's a story that Terry Metalis tells of that when Frakes was directing episodes of season two, and Metalis was writing and like running the writer's room, he told a story about how Jonathan Frakes came up to talk to him in the office, and he said, oh, by the way, there's going to be a lot of Riker in this season. And Jonathan Frakes said to him, I don't think that's a good idea. I'm not a very good actor.
Really? Who are you going to get to play him?
No. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And he was like, I don't think that's a good idea. I'm not a very good actor. And Terry Metalis said, I promise you, you can handle this, because he said that his intention was to Frakes it up a lot and to bring out more of Frakes in Riker. And,
I'm right here. It's very Frakes.
Yeah. Right.
Guys, I remembered my favorite part of the whole thing. It's when Riker finds Troy in the cell and says Imzahati, and she says, I should have taught you a different word.
Yeah.
I loved how the show was like, it was nostalgia, but they also were kind of aware of some
stuff. I love what she said. Oh, I could tell he wasn't you.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He was good in bed and terrible at pizza.
Yeah. Well, they definitely gave. Now, there was some talk early on, because Marina Sirtis didn't show up in the season until later, that there were some fans that were like thinking that that was somehow a slight against her. And Jerry Ryan, like online, like seriously jumped to the defense of all that and said, hey, you know, sometimes actors want their schedule to be the way it is for a reason, and y'all need to back off.
But they used her perfectly. That was the perfect way to bring her into the story, I thought.
Yeah. I thought the way that they slowly introduced the characters was good. That it was Riker from the beginning. And first of all, putting Riker back on the Titan, I know they kind of mentioned that it was the same ship retrofitted, and that, you know, they gave lip service to the novels and
Elizabeth, they used Elizabeth.
Yes. And Terry Metalis references the novels a couple times and has said on interviews, for example, the fact that it was a Una McCormick novel that established that when Picard left to do the Romulan relocation, that Worf took over command of the Enterprise E. And so him saying that was not my fault, put it into canon that he was the captain of the Enterprise. And put reference to the novels, and also that there was references to the Titan novels. And the fact that, which is interesting too, because it wasn't mentioned, and I was kind of hoping that they would do this, but Tuvok served on Riker's Titan in the novels. So I was kind of hoping that they did that when they had Tuvok come back. And, I did think that everybody's back was kind of convenient, and that was a little bit much. At the same time, I love Tim Russ. I loved him being there. So I can just deal with it. I'll just deal with it, you know?
Well, I thought it made perfect sense to have people calling their friends.
Yes. I loved that scene. And I thought that scene was great. And the changeling Tuvok was chilling. Actually, I thought it worked really, really well.
See, yeah. I loved it from that angle, but from another angle, wouldn't you wait until you'd turned off the comms to have the, that's not Tuvok? You don't want them to know you figured it out.
Yeah.
Instead of her just saying like, yeah, I know.
Thank you. Well, let us know if you have any more information. Click.
Yeah.
There's no way, you know.
Well, they wanted to have Tuvok. And I did think it was good to because I thought it was a great performance by Tim Russ to just change on a dime, you know, and say all that stuff. So they would have lost that moment.
Speaking of changing on the dime, Brent Spiner did a great job of that.
Yes.
But I really thought when it came down to the fight between him and Lore for control, they had dropped in that Lal was in there too.
Yeah.
And I thought Lal jumping in on Data's side was where they were going.
Yeah, that would have been
but
great.
But they didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was weird.
They may have wanted to, but not found the right actor or whatever. Or not being able to find the actor who played Lal. Maybe it didn't work. I don't know. Who knows?
Maybe they're dead. Who knows? But you could have done a voiceover.
Yeah. Yes.
I thought it was also very, the Data Lore stuff was, you know, a lot of this was like, we've seen all of this before, you know, like, you know, Return of the Jedi, whatever. But I mean, from Star Trek, we've seen all this before.
And do you think Return of the Jedi was the first time they did that? But go on.
Well, the Data Lore stuff, when I was watching Data switch personalities between one and the other, I was just like, feel like I've seen this before, you know, like that was almost like a bridge too far for me of just showing us the same thing again instead of showing us a new version of the same thing. But it was fine. It was good.
Yeah, the Data stuff kind of pushed the suspension of disbelief a little bit for me. And I love that Terry Metalis said, "You will never play another Soong on my watch." Like, you know, I love that Terry Metalis has said, like, listen, I was not going to do that. And, but at the same time, I couldn't imagine them doing this without Data being there.
No, they needed him. It worked out fine.
I'll be right back.
Yeah. Well, and so, yeah, they couldn't have not done that. And I think, I don't know, Sarah, did you have a most valuable returning character? For me, it was definitely Worf. I thought Michael Dorn
I think that, you know, I was actually really happy with the way that they ended Rafi's storyline. And I really appreciated that because the character received so much abuse. I mean, one of the things that drove me so crazy about this reaction is that that Shaw was basically a light version of Rafi. You know, Shaw was just sort of very hardened and had some self-destructive qualities because of what he had been through, had some trauma issues that he was dealing with in not healthy ways, somehow was still allowed to have his job, you know, and fine, we'll gloss over that. We've done it before in Star Trek. But like, you know, and so the fact that I remember tweeting like last season, like I really want to make sure that Rafi gets to see her grandchild and is redeemed through all of this. And I thought it was really cool that Worf understood that Rafi's gift is intuition, that because Rafi's gift is intuition, it sort of makes her seem crazy from people around her who confuse her intuition with her way of self-medicating that intuition. You know, I didn't like the fact that she showed up literally a minute before the recruitment center blew up. That was another plot contrivance of Metalis that drove me absolutely at the wall. And I don't mean to disappoint you, David, but I could not continue with 12 Monkeys because they did the same shit. He really loves to make characters act stupid when it serves the plot, Metalis. And it drove me, it's why I stopped watching 12 Monkeys, in addition to not really liking the leads that much. But anyway, I really loved the fact that they tied up Rafi and that she was a significant part of this season, because I really was so mad at the way that they treated her for several seasons. She was a great character. There was a lot of misogyny and a lot of misogynoir directed at her. And even just the fact that, you know, people will be like, well, it's the addiction issue. Yeah. And you know what? I think it's great that they were like, they answered the question, what would addiction look like in the Starfleet world? Because if Starfleet is, again, this Hogwarts organization that controls your every move and prevents you from making your own mistakes, it's not a utopia at all. It's a dystopia. And so the fact that she is allowed to make mistakes and have an addiction, and yet Starfleet is still like, we're still going to give you a roof over your head. But if you are determined to still be addicted and have all these things, that's fine. You're allowed to make that choice. We wish you didn't. Here are some resources if you change your mind. You know, because that's how we should be treating members of our society who have addiction problems. Here's a roof over your head. Here's the tools that you need if you want to get out of it. But it's up to you whether you know, want to pursue this. So I really loved everything, the way that they wrapped up Rafi as a character, and the fact that Worf was her biggest defender and understood why, who she is and what makes her tick.
I love that he said her full name every time.
Yes. Yeah. Rafaela.
Yeah.
I had to see, this is one of those things where, as the superpowers build up over the years for what they can and can't do medically, you start to wonder why they can't just give someone a shot and they're not an addict anymore, or go and they're not an addict anymore. I mean, it's sort of like the kind of thing you'd think they'd have figured out by then.
But they also think, new drugs.
I think they can. I think that if she were to go into, for instance, go into a treatment center, they would probably be able to give her a drug that helps her to not go through withdrawal. But I think that the point that they're trying to make here is that a certain percentage of addicts will want to be addicts. That's part of it, right? So right. I do think that there are treatment options for those who want to pursue them.
But I think they would just be, okay, go home.
Yeah, but they have to want to go in there and do it. That's the thing. And Rafi, I like Rafi as a character. I love that they, well, first of all, Michael Dorn and Michelle Hurd, like, obviously loved working with each other, and they've talked about it. Yes.
I can tell you that much behind the scenes. They did.
Yes. In interviews, they've talked about it, and they obviously loved working with each other, and those characters were great together. They found a really great way to, I personally love that, you know, imagine Worf lost the Enterprise E, right? And something happened, and then he's going to be like, all right, well, I got to do something else. And then he goes and does his warrior monk thing. But Starfleet's still going to be like, hey, well, Ro obviously comes to her and says, like, hey, I need you because, you know, you were on the front lines of the Dominion War, and I need you for this project because I'm trying to find these changelings. So I thought it made perfect sense. I love that. I love that he and Rafi worked well together. I liked that we had at least one character from the first two seasons that they wrapped up a storyline and found a good way to work it in with Worf. Now, let's talk about, do you have something you want to say about Rafi, John?
Well, no, I was going to change the subject to something else.
All right, well, then let me change the subject to something else, which is...
Oh, please. It's like it's your podcast.
Oh, yes, I know. Well, so for me, I was watching this week to week, and I'm Issa, my buddy over here, is refusing to watch it until he can watch it all at once. And I'm having the problem of the morning of the Ro Laren episode, and Issa and I are texting about something else, and I'm just like, fuck, dude, I want to like tell you, but I can't tell you. And like, I'm like, holy shit, you got to watch this. For me, the biggest revelation, the biggest jaw-dropping moment for me was that they got Michelle Forbes back and that they finished the Ro storyline, because it was a dangling thread and it was one I didn't think that they were going to solve or answer. And for me, as a Deep Space Nine fan and somebody who actually likes Bajoran politics, believe it or not, you know, and all that stuff, the fact that they solved the Roe and the Roe storyline. Roe is one of my favorite characters on Next Gen because she was flawed, and there were so few characters with flaws. And that was my biggest problem with TNG.
Can someone catch me up on what the Roe Picard relationship was? Because I was very confused in that part.
Boy, you didn't remember that one?
I didn't at all.
Okay, so the penultimate episode of Next Gen, like Roe, like Picard puts Roe in as a spy into the Maquis, and Roe betrays Picard and almost shoots Riker.
I didn't remember that at all. I guess
a phaser on Riker to escape and become a Maquis double. You know, basically, she goes with the Maquis. So, yeah,
I don't have any memory of that. Like, that's so weird. Obviously, I saw the end of Next Generation, but I don't recall that at all. So I'll have to go.
You have to rewatch it every 5 years, like the rest of us, Issa.
I haven't seen it since it aired.
I also want to point out something. It is in the grand Star Trek, not Star Trek per se, but let's say in the grand TNG tradition, to have the first two seasons be comparatively weak.
Yes.
I mean, come on, go back and watch the first two seasons of TNG.
Yeah, they're pretty big. I started rewatching TNG about during the pandemic with my wife and our older daughter. And we made it through the first few seasons, and then they gave up. So we didn't watch the whole thing. We were doing like an episode guide, just watch these key episodes. But they got a little more. They're not science fiction.
Well, that's because you should have started at season three. Some
stuff you have to see. I mean, I felt like we were watching a pretty good episode guide order, you know, like you got all the key moments in, you know. But they were just bored. And then I think the pandemic ended or something. So then it was like, whatever. There was no chance.
Darn.
Yeah. I know. Seriously, the stupid pandemic was over now. God, ruined everything. Yeah. No.
So the Roe thing was not like a big deal to you.
Yeah, I didn't remember it at all. I was like, what are they talking about? And I assumed it was from like some other show that I hadn't seen, but I couldn't figure out what it was. But I didn't remember that from Next Gen at all.
Oh, see, because like for me, as somebody who loved that, who thought that, you know, because that was the one time that Picard really got betrayed by one of his crew. And so he was pissed, you know, he was really, really angry. And so I thought that was so in the context of this season, it was huge that they had Roe come back. And so part of the storyline that makes it so powerful is that Picard didn't want her to wear her Bajoran earring at the beginning.
Right.
So her giving him the earring was, you know, that's what was great when Riker said this was excellent spycraft. Yeah. And so I loved the whole Roe thing. I thought it was a huge coup that they were able to keep that quiet. That was a big deal. And especially getting Michelle Forbes back after her being such a boss on Battlestar Galactica and playing a villain on that show, basically. Right. And so, you know, it was a pretty big deal. And so that to me, I think the two best things of the early part of the seasons was that the episode four was with the space babies was such a strong episode. And because I think they did a great job. One of the reasons why that episode worked so well is they ended episode three feeling so freaking hopeless. And to have Riker just say, congratulations, you just got us killed, which a lot of people thought was super harsh.
I thought that was way over the top. Like I was like that.
I didn't buy it. He might have said, you know, please get off the bridge or whatever, but I don't think he would have dressed him down like that in front of the entire crew. It was just, I felt like it was one of those plot contrivance moments that Metellus, I feel like, does, where he just sort of has people act slightly out of character in order to advance the plot along.
I would agree with you, except they did a great job in the episode of having Riker like push back against Picard multiple times. And then when he finally is like, fine, I'll do your plan. And the fact that the portal weapon like caused that, you know, it backfired and Picard's plan backfired, I could see why Riker would be pissed at that moment. I actually thought of, yeah, I could see why you don't like it. It worked for me.
I felt like that whole section where it was like the authority on the ship and Shaw was really mean to the legends. Like none of that landed for me. Like I was like, this all seemed.
Well, it made sense later when he gives his speech about how he still has issues with Locutus.
Excellently performed scene by Todd.
Yeah,
that was really good.
Reason why that was, I think, so good is that basically, and you got to give that guy credit, because at the beginning of the season, everyone's like, who is this asshole? Fuck him. And the fact that by the end, when he dies, everyone's like, we're going to riot. You know, it showed that they had an evolving character and
well, it showed that they can only have that level of empathy for men who look like them. But I digress.
I'm gonna jump to the end of Picard here because I have to cut out in about 3 minutes.
Okay.
Two things bothered me about the end. First of all, you're never going to top the end of Save the Whales when Kirk and crew come up around. Come up on the Enterprise A. Now it seems they've replaced the Enterprises so quickly and so fast that it sort of started to lose all meaning. I wanted them to make it the NCC 1701 Picard. Because that would have been, but also in that scene where she says, where at the very end, where Seven says to Jack, you'll be the special ship's counselor.
Right.
I just did not work.
Yeah.
Partly because what I in my heart wanted her to say was, oh, yes, you're the ship's mascot.
Yeah.
You're the ship's mascot. Because I listened to how many times you said you were willing to be turned over to the enemy. So if when that happens again, which it will, you're up. But no, the actual position he should have had was yeoman.
Yeah. Or go to a science station ensign crusher, you know, go over there.
He has medical training. I don't know why he'd be on the bridge at all, but again, because he's Picard's son, they do want to have him on the bridge.
As my friend Keith DeCanada wrote in his review, it's continuing the long tradition of in TNG of having a crusher on the bridge. As some sort of made up position just to have him on the bridge.
Right.
It was a very good season. I'll come back some other time if you'll have me and talk about Strange New Worlds and which is very strong, but did at least one thing that I think is atrocious.
Oh,
so I'm going to leave you on a cliffhanger.
Was it the fairy?
Sorry.
Was it the fairy tale episode or something different?
No, that was just bad.
Yeah.
It was just their attempt to do a holodeck episode.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes. Well,
John, it was nice meeting you.
It was nice meeting you all. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh,
I'll try to show up on time with clothes on next time. And Sarah, I have to ask you, why does your dog do duck imitations?
Duck imitations, like
some regular quacking earlier.
Yeah,
she's very confused. She's some kind of mystery mutt. We have no idea. She could actually be part duck. I don't know, but she's a very cat-like dog, and she's very neurotic. So makes sense.
Okay. All right, so a for pleasure the rest to meet of the crew, you. We have about 15 more minutes. Let's go through like the end of the season. John, thank you for joining us at least for as long as
you're very welcome.
And, I always love to talk to you. And again, thank you for all your work in the 90s. I love your era of Star Trek books. To me, it's the best era. So
to me too.
Yeah. I know.
Bye. Thanks, guys.
But, so for this crew, we still need to talk about like the end. What did you guys think about the reveal of the Enterprise D? I tried to get Dano to come on this episode, but the morning that appeared, he sent me a text that said, because this is what he always says about the bridge at the Enterprise D. He said the Holiday Inn Express bridge is back, which cracked me up. I thought, look, it was a cool reveal. I kind of guessed when they did the museum and they said they had on Twitter, people were saying what, because they hinted that there was something going on in Hangar Bay 12. So there was a degree that I was like, is it going to be the Enterprise? But they could have just as easily taken any of the ships. And I do like what John said about it would have been cool to have all the ships come back. However, for me, and they could have fixed this very easily, it was very hard for me that, all right, five of us are going to run this ginormous ship by themselves.
I was thinking that the whole time. It's like, why did you have a crew before?
And they kind of said the thing about, I got drones down there, and they could have solved it with Geordi could have had a crew from the museum who was ready to go, and then just had like a skeleton crew, but just had a few people, just have somebody down in engineering, something right. Like it would have, I just had the hardest time with that. It was just like the transporting to Kronos in Star Trek Into Darkness. It just broke me a little bit.
Well, and why would they have more than a few? They said, oh, we only have a few weapons. And then they went on and just apparently had an endless supply of weapons.
Right.
I wouldn't care about a lot of these nitpicks if the fanboys were not losing their fucking minds with just jizzing all over. Right. And it's just like, come on, guys.
Exactly.
Have a little self-awareness.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And so, you know, I do think the scenes were really well played when they were, you know, and they obviously let them improv. I'm pretty sure it was an improv, like Patrick Stewart's line about the carpet, which was great.
Well, here's the thing about that. What I love about that, about the carpet scene and a lot of other little moments like that, is that we've started to break the fourth wall in that there are a lot of things in all three seasons that were more about Star Trek as it exists in the culture than Star Trek within its own interior thing. And I actually really like that they do that. For example, I think that Chabon is particularly sensitive to how Patrick Stewart is perceived by fans as this kind of father figure. And he, and that Elnor represented the fans. Elnor represented the, you know, sort of, I love you, you don't know who I am, you don't care about me thing. And I feel like they play with things like that, and they play with things like the carpeting thing. The carpeting thing was a big runtime joke on Star Trek ship posting, where I talked about this in, you know, in terms of Lower Decks, where I feel like there are definitely writers for Star Trek who lurk those groups. And the carpeting thing has been a joke in that group for a long time. And so to see that was like, they're breaking the fourth wall in a really lovely way, but in a very serious way. I'm really glad that we have Jack Crusher. I'm so glad, because I don't think I could handle the loss of Patrick Stewart. Like, I will be straight up mourning for months. I'll be wearing black the whole thing when he finally perishes at 147.
How will we know the difference?
All right. Well, but like, and I love the fact that they're giving us this character that, you know, means that whether, you know, obviously this show is going to happen. I don't know whether it'll happen right away. They might want to do movies first. They might want to, you know, tease out the way that he's introduced and the way that they pick up his thread. But I think it's pretty safe to say, given how the viewership numbers are so strong for this season, with all the fucking petitions out there, that we're going to get a series with Jack Crusher.
Dude, you got to give Terry Metalis credit. He backdoor piloted the shit out of that, of what he wanted.
You know, it was funny because I had no idea that was coming. Like, I hadn't read anything about it. I didn't know there was going to be another show or anything like that. But I knew
it was coming.
I was suspicious by how much screen time that bridge crew was getting. I was like, they're getting a strange amount of screen time. I wonder if they're trying to like make these characters into something. And of course they were. So that was
part of the whole thing is that they were trying to set up the whole, you know, the fact that the theme of the original show was called The Next Generation. And, right. you know, having the idea that their age was the thing that saved the day for the young people was the theme. And that was, they started backwards from that concept. Terry Metalis has said that they wanted their age to save the day. And the joke about, I've never been so happy to see so many wrinkles, which was a great joke, you know, for Marina Sirtis. So yeah. We'll get into more of the Star Trek legacy thing in a little bit, but as far as all the legacy characters, I think everybody got something and did well. I think Gates McFadden was great. Beverly Crusher was amazing in this season. Like, her intro to the season was great, even though they fridged her for a little bit. But she science the shit out of everything that in the story. The setup of her like lying to Picard or ghosting everybody was a little weird, but I think she was great. I think LeVar Burton they all kind of had rough starts, but I definitely think Michael Dorn was the MVP of the Michael Dorn and Jonathan Franks were the MVPs, but Gates McFadden and Marina Sirtis, all, you know, Brent Spiner, they all did great. They all did great. Now, for me, that meant from the beginning, like throughout the promotion process, you know, Jonathan Franks and a couple other, Patrick Stewart has said, well, maybe we could do more. My personal feeling is let it go. You know, you got a good ending. Be over. If Star Trek Legacy, if you want to have like little cameos here and there, you want to pop up for a storyline, a couple arcs, whatever, do not do a whole nother series of this cast. Let it be a good ending. This is your Undiscovered Country. This is your great ending. You know, how do you guys feel about that? Because I think it's
I think you can still do, you know, like Chekhov's son was the president, right? Like, I think that kind of stuff you can still do. But I think it is better to let it go and not have the characters. That was a good ending. You know, like, I don't need to see Data again being Lore, whatever. I know that's done, but that was just, I don't mean to nitpick on that because I obviously really enjoy Data. The Stranger Things theme song. Where did that come from? Like the Stranger Things synth. Did you guys notice that? Like, that drove me crazy. I was like, why is this in here? That was very strange.
I did not notice that, but
okay. I didn't notice that at all.
There are like two times where they have some riff that sounds exactly like the Stranger Things theme, and that was just really weird. It was like this 80s synth heavy bass line kind of thing. Okay, whatever. I'm a music nerd too. So I thought it was a great ending. I mean, obviously at some point they need to stop using the TNG characters, but I mean, that's a good way to go out.
Yeah. And I mean, I would watch the hell out of a Worf Raffi show being spies, but they're obviously not going to do that. They went another direction with that. But if they had done that, I would have watched the hell out of
I think that Section 31 is the perfect fit for Worf because he wants to do the beheadings, right? But he also has this Zen quality that makes the combination of the two hilarious. I think that they are setting him up to be in the Michelle Yeoh Section 31 movie.
That would be amazing, actually. Because she could go, she's stepping into the Guardian of Forever, so she can go anywhere. Yeah. She can go anytime. So, and what?
I mean, they said that it's going to be a Section 31 movie. So,
yeah,
you know.
Could be. So we talked about the Enterprise reveal. Yeah, I mean, because it makes sense that it's only the saucer section of the original ship. The rest blew up. So the bottom half is another ship, which, by the way, shout out to the USS Syracuse, a city I used to live in. that the bottom of the ship is apparently the USS Syracuse. So shout out. So what happened to the saucer section of the Syracuse? I wonder. I thought, yeah, the museum thing and all the starships was great. Now the setting up of I agree. I would have been fine with Star Trek Legacy still being the Titan. And I didn't need it to be the Enterprise, but I understand the decision. And the emotional thing about that is, as a fan of Voyager, who was not instantly in love with the character of Seven of Nine, but eventually did fall in love with the character of Seven of Nine, to see that character go from assimilated Borg, ripped from the collective, to a bisexual captain of the Enterprise is a fucking awesome journey, and they earned it, and they took her, in my opinion, by going through all these steps and like having her character go through these things. It would have made more sense to have Janeway do it than Tuvok. But at the same time, I understand that they probably asked Kate Mulgrew and she probably said no. But
wasn't there an article about it that said that they just did not have the budget? They just could not afford to bring back that many people.
Well, that's what they're saying.
I thought I saw that.
Yeah, but who knows? But Tuvok, they did have a relationship on the show. And, Jeri Ryan seems like every time she talks about Tim Russ, she gets all like excited. So she obviously had a connection to him as an actor. Yeah. And by the way, Tim Russ is a star nerd and an astronomy nerd who goes to dark sky events all over Southern California with all of his rigs. So I got mad respect for Tim Russ.
That's adorable.
And apparently I had been at a sky party with him and didn't know it. Yeah. And I may have even like looked through his telescope, and just because you don't necessarily talk to everyone, you just kind of walk around, do your thing. And I had a friend tell me, he was like, oh yeah, Tim Russ was here tonight. He had his setup. He was looking at star clusters all night. Just like,
you're like, you're telling me this now? Like, probably a good thing that you didn't know, right?
I would have been cool.
Oh yeah, it would have been.
Yeah, cool. I mean, he's Tuvok. It's not like it's Leonard Nimoy, right?
Sure.
Okay, he's pretty cool. Anyways, so my point is that I didn't need for it to be the Enterprise, but I understand that if you're gonna do a new series set in the early 25th century, and they haven't announced everything, and Terry Metalis has been very political about saying no announcements have been made, it's just a dream for me, but as successful as it's been, they would be crazy not to green light a Seven Raffi Star Trek Legacy with Jack Crusher on the crew. They've done everything to set it up. Like, it would be awesome. And I like the idea that it's not the biggest, hugest, most flagshipy ship of the Enterprise, you know, that it's kind of like, it would be a different position, and it would just be respect for what they did, that they named it the Enterprise, whatever. Anyways, but obviously the Enterprise, F and Shelby did not have a good day there, but that was also cool to bring back Shelby. That's a deep Easter egg. She was only in one episode of TNG, right?
Two, technically.
Two. Yeah,
she was in the season finale and then the season premiere, because remember that whole summer we had to fucking wait to find out what happened.
Right. And I will say this for Shelby, and John was the one who did this, and he's gone, but they created the New Frontier novels, John and Peter. And there's like 10 or 12 of those novels, and she's the first officer and takes command of the Excalibur. And that's the ship in the New Frontier books. And she's a major character in all those books. So if people haven't read those, they're really good. Peter David was one of the best Star Trek novelists working back then. And apparently, by the way, going through some serious health issues, and because he's an author, doesn't have healthcare. So if you look up Peter David, there is a GoFundMe for his healthcare stuff. So since we're talking about it, I should mention that. And Peter David also wrote some of the best Q novels during that era of Star Trek. So just shout out to those. But anything else you guys have any thoughts about this idea of Star Trek Legacy and doing the new show, Sarah? I understand your feelings about the Metallus fandom thing, but
I actually give him a pass about naming it Enterprise, because if you're going to do a next generation reboot of sorts and you're going to have some legacy characters involved, I mean, that would be the most natural fit, right? It would be the most natural fit for guest stars to show up for. And I loved that, you know, even though some of you did not like how much time they gave to the Picard Jack relationship, I appreciate the fact that they did that, because they're not going to have another opportunity to do that pretty much ever, unless, you know, there is another TNG focused film or something like that. And so I really appreciate the fact that they gave you a really good solid character study with the two of them getting to know each other. I would have hated if all that happened was, you know, sort of, oh, that happened off screen while they all solved this.
Like, as long as Legacy is not these season long, like, end of the universe every time, they got to take the new Strange New Worlds path.
I'm very worried that I don't want them to necessarily do Strange New Worlds, but I am very worried about the Marvel-esque of Star Trek. I am a very casual fan of Marvel for a reason. I most of the Marvel films are disposable. You watch them once and then it's done. Like, I loved Black Panther. I loved Ragnarok. That's basically it. And I feel like Star Trek should use restraint. And again, this comes down to the homogenization thing that's happening, right? Like, oh, well, because that is popular over there, let's copy them. No, carve out your own fucking identity. You're Star Trek. You're your own franchise. You do your own thing. You don't need to fucking do what they're doing over there, because then everything starts to look the same. And I hate it. And everything starts to sound the same. Like, let them have their own identity. You have yours. And maybe, so I would love it if they actually had, you know, season long plots, but don't have it be universe ending season long plots. Cause I'm tired of it. I'm tired of the constant drama. Because
the thing is, if Discovery had done a season long arc about the rebuilding of the Federation, that's a story worth telling, and the universe isn't ending, but it's a story worth telling over a season.
Well, I think that's what they're going to do with Starfleet Academy. Yeah. You know, I think
I think it's a mistake to be concerned about whether it's a season long arc or episodic or whatever. As long as it's good, you can get away with either, as long as it fits. That's really all that.
That's true.
I mean, the only reason that it bothers you that every season is like a escalating universe ending thing is because it just wasn't as good as it could have been, right? If it had been better, you'd be like, this is awesome.
I think Discovery actually did the best among those pattern. I think Discovery is the one that did the best with that.
Season two, I thought.
Discovery is incredibly epic. And it was so funny.
We've all talked about Discovery and how David and I like thought it peaked before they went to the future or whatever.
I like season three and four. That's not the issue. It's that I think they told the wrong stories there, because
I agree.
Because the thing is, I think the rebuilding of the Federation is more interesting than well, I mean, the burn, it just wasn't, it's how they resolved it wasn't great, but I like Discovery. I'm not talking shit on Discovery. I love Discovery. I'm sad that we only get one more season, and I hope it goes out with a bang. But that being said, I just think, I don't know, I just don't think the whole universe has to be on the line each time, because partially because it's like, well, first of all, the one the major problem with Picard that not enough people are talking about it with Picard season three is that it has kind of the same ending as Prodigy, right? Like the linked ships and the formation like thing, like it's, they should have learned their lesson after the events of Prodigy, right? They should have, if we're in the same timeline, we've been like, oh, maybe linking all of our ships together is not a good idea, because remember,
well, that the changelings were the ones who tripped Starfleet into doing that, right?
Well, so that's the argument that you can make, and that's fine, and I can live with that story-wise, but of all the nitpicking, that's the least of my concern. I'm honestly more concerned about the five people running the Enterprise, like makes my skin crawl a little bit. So hey, Carrie's home, so it's a good time to start wrapping up. But here's the thing. So what do you guys, so next we have Strange New World season two coming in June. So the next two things that Star Trek has are Strange New Worlds, and we have, after that, we have, I think, maybe, no, Discovery is coming after that, or maybe it's, I don't know.
I have a theory that they're not actually canceling Discovery, because I think that you know, they originally had seven seasons planned, right? That's what they said. They originally had this whole thing. And so this would be, what, the fifth season, I think? I really think that they might be, because Kurtzman announced that they were doing the Section 31 movie with Michelle Yeoh. Then a week later, he actually mentioned, he said, actually, I would like to do a Star Trek movie, full-length movie, once a year. And that, to me, suggests that Discovery, they might tell the rest of that story with Discovery.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah. Or
also, it depends how popular season five is. I think that'll change a lot of things too. So, you know.
Well, and also, you know, Trekkies have a long history of deciding that they suddenly love a Star Trek series that has been canceled or that's off the air, right? I think that is sort of what makes Trekkies sort of warm up to it. I think it takes them a while, some of them, and they do this thing where when it's the new thing, they're like, "Oh, we hate it," and they did this with TNG. And then when it's no longer the new thing and there's another new thing to hate, they're like, oh, we love that show. We never talk bad about that show. What are you talking about?
Yeah, totally.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm excited that they're doing one-off movies for streaming. And I think that can expand the Star Trek universe, because you could do things that you couldn't do otherwise. Like, you could do a Worf adventure here and there, or you know, Dr. Crusher story, yeah, that's like a one-off, and I think that's great. You know, and if the popularity of these, you know, they're seeing the popularity of these TNG characters, they're gonna get one-offs here and there. So all right. Yeah. Well, we've gone for a while here, so I think it is a good time to wrap up. But overall, I love the season. I, you know, super enjoyed it. To me, the two highlights were episode four and the Ro Laren thing, which meant nothing to Issa, which is really funny.
No, I really liked it.
You should have messaged me, because I was all about it. I was, well, like, I mean, I watched it
like yesterday, right? So, yeah. But no, I didn't remember the details. I remembered Ro Laren. I didn't remember the details of the falling out at the end. But yeah. I enjoyed her. I wish they'd used her more. Like, it seemed very short, and she seemed like she died in a really stupid way. Like, she should have been more suspicious or whatever. But, you know, I really enjoyed it.
Well, you know,
she should have been more suspicious. She was one of the few people who understood what was going on.
Yeah, exactly. And she got the information to Picard. So she did. She helped save the galaxy. So, yeah, good on her. So, let's hear it for Starfleet rehabilitation. Because, you know, I didn't have a problem with Maki, but, you know, a lot of people did. So whatever, you know. But hopefully we'll be doing episodes about Star Trek Legacy in the future. We'll see. But So Star Trek Picard. Sarah, where can people find you if they want to find you, if they want to talk to you about these things?
Probably
do you want
Facebook.
Them to find you?
It's funny. I left Twitter as soon as Elon Musk took over. I was like, fuck this shit. And I think it was when he decided he was going to let the Orange Menace back on. And then I've been missing it only because of the Star Trek conversations. I'm like, damn it. Like the fact that Terry Metalis is out there answering questions, I wouldn't know that because I haven't been on Twitter since I quit my Twitter. So
yeah, I don't know how he does it. I don't know how he does it because he's more patient than I would ever be. Because
I have questions for him.
We should get back on just for that. Well, he responds to a lot of things. He's not responding to, we forgot to talk about Laris. He has not responded to the justice for Laris thing.
Maybe that means that they have a plan for her, because I feel like if they didn't have a plan for her, they
why
would
they
be more
it?
Likely to say, right.
Yeah, why did they mention, like, I'll be waiting for you if right. you're not going to show him showing up? So there's some hilarious memes about Chateau Laris, because, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law in Romulan society. So there's all this. These jokes about how she's running Chateau Laris now, and
it's yeah, very
and but yeah, I do not understand that. But we did talk about Laris a little bit. We did talk about that. So, yeah. Issa, do you want anyone to find you?
You know, I was never on Twitter in the first place. I'm not a fan. I don't understand it at all because I'm just old, apparently. But you can find me somewhere if you try. It's really easy to find me. You don't want to talk to me about Star Trek though, so yeah. If you didn't hear it here, you don't need to hear it. It's not important. So.
Well, hopefully soon we're going to be doing the Star Wars Jedi Council about Mandalorian and Bad Batch. If we can convince you to watch Bad Batch,
I will never make it through Bad Batch. Like I've been trying to watch it for a long time. I'm still on episode one. I just you know, busy schedule, but I will watch the Mandalorian. That's probably the next thing I'm going to watch now that Picard's over.
All right. Well, I think you should watch Bad Batch. It gets really good. But
I believe you. I need to, like, if I'm ever on like a vacation and have a long plane ride where I can't work or something, then I'll do it. You know, startup life. I'm busy. It's hard to get.
Sarah, can we meet your doggy real quick?
This is Luna the mystery mutt.
Yeah, she's very cute. All right. On that note. We'll end on Luna. But folks, if you want to talk Star Trek with us, you know, you can find me. Well, I'll talk about Star Trek all day. So, and hopefully, I know we'll be back for Strange New World. So see everybody with Strange New World season 2. And until then, live long and prosper and all that. And we'll talk again.